Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. Bob Garfield is out this week, and as many of you know by now, every week, having been fired after a warning and other efforts at amelioration for a pattern of bullying behavior. The entire staff agreed with that decision. The problem was not over-passionate discourse. We don't fear that. We've even put some of our own on the radio. Nor was it merely about yelling. But there's not much more I can say. Look, you know how this works. One side, as an individual, is free to present their case however they see it or wish to see it. They may describe their conduct in ways the other side might not even recognize. But that other side cannot engage because they're part of a bigger enterprise that balances many concerns, including legal ones. I know it's unsatisfying, as much for a show as deeply devoted to transparency as ours, as for some of you. But even if we could be totally transparent, the view would likely still be obscured under a heap of he said, they said. In the end, it really comes down to trust, most especially and relevantly in the show, and what it offers today, next week, and the week after that. And so, dear listeners, on with the show. Back when the pandemic started, so many lifetimes ago, we, that is to say, all the humans on the planet, were faced with a host of questions. How does the virus that causes COVID-19, called SARS-CoV-2, spread? How do we protect ourselves? And somewhere further down the list, amid so much confusion and loss, how did it start infecting humans?
As scientists work to contain the coronavirus, researchers are still trying to figure out where it came from. Early research suggests human picked up the coronavirus from animals, possibly bats.
We know it's very similar to the virus in the bat, but did it go through an intermediate species? So this is a question we all need answered.
One possible scenario emerged early and then promptly retreated from mainstream scientific discourse, the theory that it had leaked from a lab. It's an idea that hinges on two key facts. One, that the first outbreak of the virus occurred in Wuhan, China. And two, that Wuhan is the home to the Wuhan Institute of Virology, a lab that studies active coronaviruses like SARS-CoV-2. That a lab leak could have been the source of this coronavirus seemed at first, to a layperson, at least plausible. But it was quickly swatted down when an international group of scientists published an open letter in The Lancet in February 2020 condemning, quote, conspiracy theories suggesting that COVID-19 does not have a natural origin.
Most scientists think that bats are the original source of the virus, and then it jumped to humans in a Wuhan wet market.
Too many perfect coincidences would have had to take place for it to have escaped from a lab.
There is also no reason to believe any of these conspiracy theories that it was leaked from the lab in Wuhan, whether intentionally or otherwise.
One group, however, saw a political opportunity in the lab leak theory. It's the same group that was banging on about the China virus.
Both President Trump and Secretary of State Mike Pompeo linked the virus to a lab in Wuhan without providing evidence.
Have you seen anything at this point that gives you a high degree of confidence that the Wuhan Institute of Virology was the origin of this virus?
Yes, I have.
Thus, it became a notion embraced by the conspiratorial right, but mostly shunned by the scientific community. And scientists who did explore it, people like Alina Chan of the Broad Institute at Harvard and MIT, were tarred as conspiracy theorists. That is, until this month, when a group of 18 prominent scientists, some of the most trusted virologists and epidemiologists studying COVID-19, penned an open letter in the journal Science titled, Investigate the Origins of COVID-19. Alina Chan was one of them.
Yes, I think this letter will go down in history as being the turning point when leading scientists, say that we have to investigate the lab leak hypotheses.
None of the scientists assert that the virus did, in fact, leak from a lab. They merely ask for, quote, a dispassionate science-based discourse on the issue. And they offer a critique of the one major WHO, quote, investigation into the origins of the virus conducted by a team of international scientists, half of whom were China-based. It was the Chinese team that actually did the investigating, gathering, processing, and ultimately holding on to the data. To those who penned the open letter, the result was extremely unsatisfying.
This was not an investigation at all. They had no power. So all they could do was really look at the findings of the Chinese side of the team and think, is this reasonable? And then sign off on the document altogether to present it to the world in March of this year.
The Chinese team had four different hypotheses.
So the first was a bat-to-human direct transmission, that a virus that was in bats jumped directly into humans. The team said that it was possible, but they didn't say it was the most likely scenario, because there has been no record of such a transmission happening, at least not publicly.
What was the most likely?
That is the second scenario, where a bat first gives the virus to an animal that is more similar to humans, and then that animal gives it to humans. So it requires an intermediate host.
I remember the film Contagion. It came from a bat to a pig to a human.
Yes, exactly. And in SARS-1, it was civet cats.
Then there's the third scenario, the possibility of a lab leak. The Chinese team really didn't like that hypothesis.
The China WHO team said that it was extremely unlikely and decided not to pursue this route of investigation or study any further. That report, it was the trigger for a lot of scientists to say we need to speak up, say that a lab leak hypothesis is still plausible and worth investigating.
Then there's the frozen food scenario. The Chinese team seemed to like that one.
Yes, and again, this was another hypothesis that was very surprising to a large number of scientists. There's no precedent of a virus jumping from frozen foods into humans, as far as I know. In fact, even with this many millions of people infected, there's been no proven record of someone catching SARS-2 from a block of frozen fish or frozen meat. But yet, the China WHO team said that this was more likely than the lab leak hypothesis, which actually has precedent. SARS virus itself has leaked from a lab close to 6 times.
We know that this argument isn't merely of historical interest.
We need closure. This pandemic has affected so many lives and it's killed 3.5 million people. And we need to mitigate this kind of risk. If it did come from animals, especially illegally trafficked animals, it can help us put all the weight we have against this sort of trafficking. But if it came from a lab, even if it came from well-intentioned research, then we have to start regulating that research. This is research that sends researchers into remote areas to collect novel viruses and bring them back into densely populated cities for study. This sort of work has been pitched as pandemic predicting and preventing work, but if it actually is the source of new pandemics, then we need to have a good hard think about how we should do this sort of research in the future.
Just to clarify, nobody who signed this letter is saying that a lab leak did cause the pandemic, just that it warrants investigation, right?
Yes. And I think that's one challenge that has really obstructed the investigation of this hypothesis since the beginning, because anyone who raised the hypothesis of a lab leak was accused as sort of warmongering, as saying that this definitely came from a lab.
That anyone who suggested there was a lab leak was spreading misinformation.
There were some scientists who came out very strong at the beginning of the pandemic, when barely anything was known about the virus, said that it's clear that this is from nature. No lab-based scenario is plausible. And these works are published in The Lancet and Nature Medicine. So when you have that, then the rest of the scientific community and science journalists tend to fall in line. That set the tone for the rest of the discussion for the year, I think.
The February 2020 letter in Lancet, the first draft of it was written by a Peter Daszak, who actually had a stake of a kind in the Wuhan lab.
Peter Daszak, he's the president of an Eco Health Alliance, nonprofit organization based in New York. They received millions of dollars of funding, and part of that money was sent to the Wuhan Institute of Virology.
Let's get back to the politics for a second. In early 2020, both China and the United States started slinging theories around that China intentionally created this virus. And then there were others who said it actually came from a lab in the United States.
Yes, I think the circumstantial evidence points away from an intentional release. As to whether there was bioweapons work, like, who can tell? Most of the viruses that have escaped from labs are collected from nature. They don't need to be Frankenstein chimera built in the lab. They don't have to be bioweapons. Nature already has a lot of good stuff. It already has a lot of very scary, dangerous viruses that we can bring back into the lab and accidentally leak.
But isn't part of the problem with the resistance to looking into an accidental lab leak the fact that it has been shuffled in with these other conspiracy theories?
Yes, and so I kind of understand why some scientists were in such a rush to condemn any idea of a lab leak, because they wanted to strongly shut down any conspiracy theories about bioweapons. I understand that, but I also think that they should have more publicly explain this nuance. On the last day of 2019 and the first day of 2020, when the Beijing CDC went to sample the Wuhan market, they collected hundreds of samples from this market, including from all the animal carcasses, as well as the environment. So the surfaces, doorknobs, sewers, and there were no animal samples with this virus in it. In fact, if you read their reports, they said that there were no live mammals at this market. So it's a live animal market, but they were selling live frogs and reptiles and snakes. None of these are hosts of SARS-CoV-2 virus. There was no way for an intermediate host to be spilling over this virus into humans at that market.
Can you talk about some of the scientific misconceptions that have caused confusion around the origins of COVID-19?
One major misconception is that this SARS research at the WIV was conducted in such a safe, high biosafety level that it could never have leaked. All of this work was done at much less safe levels than people thought.
But there are a lot of labs doing this kind of work. Are there similar lapses in safety measures in all of them, including the US?
Yes, even labs with no reported biosafety incidents have biosafety incidents. If there are no accidents ever in your lab, that means you're not doing any experiments. And so in the case of the first SARS virus, it escaped from a lab in Singapore, it escaped from BSL-4 in Taiwan, it escaped about four times from a single lab in Beijing when it was being studied back in 2004. And none of these scientists were doing anything crazy with the virus. One of them didn't even work with the virus. Somehow it had contaminated his sample and he got sick. Another massive misconception is that the Wuhan Institute of Virology was built there because it's a SARS hot zone. That is completely untrue. The strongest route by which a SARS virus could get all the way from its home in South China, more than 1,000 miles into Wuhan, is, in my opinion, actually dozens of lab personnel crawling into these extremely difficult to reach caves, bringing thousands of bat samples back into the crowded city of Wuhan. It's a very modern city.
All of this makes one think that maybe we shouldn't be doing that kind of research. And you're afraid that people will come precisely to that conclusion.
It's important for us to understand what is out there. I think it's very valuable. It's not that this research should not be done. The question is, how can we make it safer? So maybe we shouldn't be doing it right smack next to an international airport. Maybe we should be doing it in a place where researchers are required to quarantine for 2 weeks or more between working at those locations and coming back into where there are millions of people in the city. There are ways to make this research safer while still doing it.
All you're asking for is an investigation. In an effort to protect scientific research, has the scientific community run the risk of undermining its own credibility?
Yes. This science letter that was just published really is a call to return back to science-based discourse. For me, the mistake would be for scientists to show the public that, no, we cannot check ourselves. We cannot audit ourselves. Scientists need to take the leadership, reviewing the research that we've been doing and saying, could this have caused the pandemic? This is a precedent-setting situation. So this is the first time there's been such a plausible scenario of a lab leak resulting in a pandemic. We really need to establish a protocol and a system where we can investigate no matter where the next possible lab leak pandemic occurs. Because if we don't investigate, then we keep letting these pass and we keep letting it go. We're just going to enter an era of lab-based pandemics. So it's just going to be every 5 to 10 years a new virus escaped from a high-security lab. We can't let that happen.
Alina, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Alina Chan is a postdoctoral researcher at the Broad Institute of MIT and Harvard. Coming up, how an argument over aerosols and droplets probably cost us a whole lot of lives. This is On the Media.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.